I'll take some time to introduce myself and Mark, and then we'll give you an outline of what the session is going to be like. Sound good?
Sounds good.
So Paul writes to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So I think it's important to keep this passage in mind throughout everything we say. If you start getting the inclination that we think that practices or certain methods are going to assure church growth or church plants, go back to this verse and remember that this is our underlying paradigm for approaching church planting. There's work for us to do. We collaborate with one another, all planted, all slaughtered. But God is sovereign over the growth. There's things we can do to participate in that work with Him, but ultimately the growth belongs to God. So I find it's always important to clarify that at the beginning of these sort of conversations. So I'll pray, and we'll get started. Father, we thank You that You're good to us. You're passionate about Your church, which means You're passionate about us. I'm grateful, Lord, for how many people are interested in church planting and growing churches as part of our denomination. Lord, help us to catch Your heart for Your church. And may church planting be a response to Your profound love for us. So in Christ's name we pray.
Amen.
So my name is Alistair. I am the chair of church planting for ANIC. And this is Mark Birch. He is one of the directors of C2C Network. We have formed a partnership that was announced, I think, in April between ANIC and C2C. C2C is a church planting network across Canada that work along many denominations. Mark and I have known each other for about 4 years now, 5 years, 4 years. Mark played a part in assessing me to church plant, and so we'll talk a bit more about all of those sort of practices in a bit. But this workshop is going to be a little bit different than us just giving you a bunch of information. I actually want to start with questions. I want to see what questions are in the room, because we do have an agenda of things we want to share, but we want to make sure we're actually sharing things in a way that's helpful to the questions that you've already come hoping to have answered. And if there's a lot of questions, then we will take a vote on which questions to answer as a group. Sound good?
If you're growing churches, how do you find the balance between the older congregation and the newer congregation who wants to change and attract younger people?
Okay. I'm just writing down the questions on my computer. If you could just say your name before the questions.
Sure. DJ, just like music.
DJ, all right.
Nice to meet you. After the initial launch, so several years in, my name's Brian. What are some of the best practices and likely challenges or hurdles?
That's a great question. Okay.
Tim, advice, experience, expertise, suggestions about church planting in small town and rural areas.
Okay, great, thank you.
Advice for planting from scratch, if you're not part of a larger community, you are just, like, two of you or maybe four of you are just starting.
Okay, so a small launch. Do you know
what you're doing? Zena, sorry.
How do you grow your budget following the size of your congregation?
I can give you a quick answer, but you tell me. It's a good question.
Hi, Father Michael. Some statistics I've read are regards to younger people are actually moving back towards liturgical and traditional worship. Do you have anything to share about that in particular?
Great. Okay.
It's about the chicken and egg problem. If you're not taking like 50 people from a larger church to plant church, but you're just starting with a couple families, and you want to attract young families, and you need children's program and all sorts of stuff, then you don't have the manpower to do it. Mm-hmm. How do you, like, yeah, you expect?
Okay.
Mark, what are the skill set you should look for in your launch?
That's a good question.
Trudy, and I've been called the official of men, actually, and I'm looking for tips on rural, small, outlying areas, but also on bait.
What kind of bait do you use? And I know we use gospel, but what's the bait?
I feel like I'm an unfair advantage to them, I guess, so I just use that as my advantage. No laugh, box.
Yeah. And we have the bait. I have the old one.
You said the bait. But yeah, what do you use?
Oh, okay, I'm Jay. Judges are very good. Fairly new judge. We're facing lots of denominations which are not letting me grow how we can go further and reach to them.
So, sorry, is the question how do we partner with other denominations?
Other denominations.
Okay.
And that's the biggest challenge, you know.
Yeah.
That they are not getting in. How can we reach to them?
Okay.
My name is Chris. My church is 2 months old. It's more of a transplant than a plant.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions on how to keep from just falling into doing what I always did.
Okay, so new patterns and essentially a culture shift.
That's right, for someone who is not trained to plant.
In the process, can you talk about two or three different models, like the missionary church plant model, and a mother daughter? Can you give us maybe three or four models?
Any more questions?
Sure. Could you say more about this key issue of taking an old DNA from the Anglican Church of Canada, which has no missional history in present generations, and how do you move that into a new DNA?
Okay. That's a good question.
Joanne, and how do you assess timing for the plant, and especially taking into account a lot of turbulence that the given congregation has gone through, and you know, how do you assess your stability for planting?
Yeah, so major milestones and all that.
Yeah.
Great.
I'm Kathy. When I'm looking at your book, and I'm thinking, yes, that's one of our problems. Competition. I don't want to call it that, because if we're in Christ, we're all one. But we're in Halifax, and we have two church planters in Dartmouth.
Yeah.
You know, and they're very modern, and we are very traditional. So that, you know, where do we bring our people in?
Archie.
Alistair, I do think I'd like to hear people given some time about finances, because that is the big bugbear in Annie as a whole. You know, if the denomination doesn't have money, or the diocese, so how do we deal with finances? Because, as you said, you know, the money doesn't grow with the numbers.
It's a really, really good question. So we're going to throw it to you.
Can I answer the question?
2 weeks.
Yeah.
If we give you our emails, so are you going to send us a list of all the answers?
Yeah, what will do?
There's no email in rural smoking.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Smoke signals.
Let me
just look at this really quickly. Because there's a few that tie in together here. There's a few themes that have been brought up, but I think these are questions that we can definitely chat through. I don't think we can provide satisfactory answers to every single one, because some of them are things that we're still figuring out what it means to exist as a denomination in this place and this time, and the unique challenges we're facing. What I would like to do is completely readapt our agenda. And what I want you to know is I've been working on some resources for ANIC, particularly answering these very questions. And so why I started with the questions is because I want to make sure the resources we put out are actually helpful. And so we're going to bounce through some of these questions today. If your question doesn't get answered today, chat with me afterwards if you need it answered immediately, or expect a resource to come out that will answer your specific question, because we want to make... I didn't want to come in here just assuming I know what questions you're asking. Some of them I expected, some of them I didn't, and this is really good. And so why don't we speak briefly about the partnership between C2C and Attic, how that partnership will affect church planting, and then some of the practices that Attic has developed. And then we'll use that as a launching pad into these questions, and we'll just go through them as they came up. So we'll skip sharing my church planting story and
boring.
So when Charlie asked me to chair this board, I said no, and he said, "Well, don't answer now." and so I prayed, and I came back, and I essentially said, "Charlie, I will chair this board on a few conditions. Like, I have a young family, and so they're my priority. I have a young church plant; that's my priority. Then the board, then church planting for Annick. So if you're okay with that, I'm okay with that." He said, "Yes." I said, "Secondly, this is my other condition: we will develop a partnership with C2C because there's no point in reinventing the wheel. I think they're, you know, I've worked with them personally." And Charlie said, "Well, let's get that conversation going." And so Charlie and the House of Bishops met and discussed, and we had conversations with C2C, and it's a very exciting partnership. You should know that C2C has really came out of the Mennonite Brethren roots, but has become a interdenominational movement. How many denominations? So they're working with 16 denominations now. And so what C2C has done is developed overarching values that all these denominations can come under. So one of the things we worry about as Anglicans is our Anglican identity, and you should know that C2C has no desire to make our identity conform to some other identity. We can preserve the uniqueness, whether you're high church, low church, somewhere in between. That's not what C2C is about. They're more about values behind the church plan and best practices that any expression of church planting, whether it's rural, whether it's urban, whether it's two people starting it, whether it's coming out of a church, these practices will apply. So, Mark, I'll hand it over to you to talk about the three values, and then we can work through the best practices.
Yeah, just dovetail a little bit with what Alistair just said, and maybe in response to the lady from Halifax, the Dartmouth, your comment about, you know, the competition with plants. We would say precisely because we have multi-denominational connections, we want to promote multi-denominational expressions. Because a Pentecostal church is going to reach different people than a Presbyterian church versus an Anglican church versus a Mennonite church. And we're like, we think we need all stripes and breeds of churches. The centrality is around Orthodox evangelical doctrines, if you will. We hold those at the core. But within that saying, every denomination and tribe has their distinctives for a reason. And they will actually attract a different type of person. Sometimes it's from family histories and others, and some of it's style of liturgical versus, you know, contemporary, all those kind of things. So we believe, even in the same corner, like Alistair's church is a great example, within a 3 or 4 block area in the downtown core, there's, what, 4 church plants?
Yeah, and then major churches.
Yeah, and then large churches. So they're within, right within walking distance. From another, in fact, one of our guys wrote an article about church planting like Starbucks. You know, just walk a block and you find another one. And it's interesting, if you go back in time, if you walk this strip of this slope here, there are a lot older church buildings. So back in the 1910s, 1920s, many churches came to this neighborhood, and they're large buildings. You would say, why so many churches along the same strip? And so it's not a matter of competition. There's a large market share out there of lost people. And that's what we'd like to focus on. Just, you know, give you a disclaimer. You will rehear some of what I say now tomorrow. I'm going to speak for 20 minutes in the plenary and talk really about the why question. We can talk about the what and the who. We are a bit of our history and those kind of things. Report in the hows, 10 best practices. Yeah, we have those that are in the booklet there, and we can dig into those a bit in this workshop. We won't spend a lot of time tomorrow talking about the details of that how type question. Those are the nuts and bolts. But really, the why question is the most important, and I mean, it just comes, I think we probably anchor it theologically, first and foremost, the love of God, and we heard that very clearly this morning. You know, God loved the world, He sent His Son, and it's not His will that anyone would perish, and so it's got to be anchored in the love of God. And then conversely, the lostness of humanity. And it was interesting this morning, listening for, you know, trigger words and keywords, and I heard the word lost or lostness several times this morning. And it was encouraging to me because many denominations are actually, we've got a missiologist and he says the evangelical church is losing, we've lost the lostness of the lost. Mm-hmm. That is evangelicals, we don't even like to use that term anymore. It's offensive, so we won't talk about lost people. And yet Jesus was so clear, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. And that has to be our focus in evangelistic outlook. And whether it's rural or urban, small church, big church, if there isn't a focus on drawing people to Jesus, then we think that's really not what the church should be all about. The values that do unite us, though, you know, when we're working, as Alistair said, grew out of Mennonite Brethren Tribe, primarily here in BC, and what happened 5, 6, 7 years ago, Mennonites from across Canada were coming to BC to visit us and saying, hey, you're getting some traction in church planting, can we learn from you? And so we began to talk about what would it look like to have a national strategy versus just a provincial strategy. And almost at that same time, other denominations began to come to us. And you say, why is that happening in Canada? And I think for a couple reasons. Because the evangelical church is so stinking small in Canada. We need one another. And what's Barry's statistician guy? Stetzer's the guy I'm thinking of. He was up here last winter sometime, doesn't matter when. And he said, his wife's a Canadian, he's American, they do a lot of research in Canada. He goes, in Canada, you don't have the option of not working together. Stateside, and he was going, please don't come to the States for your principles. Don't look to us for your principles. And the comparison he made, and he's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, he's a bit sarcastic, but in the States, denominations are large enough, many of them are large enough, they don't need to work with anybody else. So they can be their own tribe, they can do their own thing, they have their own systems, they have their own resources, and it's awesome in some regards. But in Canada, the comparison is like you're a bunch of penguins. You need to huddle together for warmth. And so most denominations don't have enough resources, money or personnel or systems to do the whole thing all by themselves. So to network together and say, okay, if we would pool our resources and leverage our common strength and leave our denominational distinctives aside, we won't argue about those things, we'll agree upon the central tenets of Christianity, and then we'll work together for the cause of the gospel. So technically, C2C does not plant churches. We come alongside church planters, churches, or denominations. And the language we use is we're like catalysts. So we will help that church get out of the gates, up and running. So our relationship with any individual congregation may be anywhere from 3 years to maybe 6 years. And then we call them, they graduate out. And they graduate into, you know, their denomination. And 99% of the planters that come to us have a denominational affiliation. And that's a good thing, because we go, we're not your long-time family. The network is not a denomination. You need a family long-term that you're going to travel with and journey with. So who are you affiliated with is one of the very first questions we ask. Do you have the support of your denomination? Then within that, there's three values that guide us. You go, okay, currently 16 denoms. If you take their, it's interesting, if you take the confession of faith of those denominations and overlap them, it's amazing how much agreement there is in our confession of faith. And then you have little distinctives that set people apart. So my home tribe, Mennonite Brethren, we have a statement on love and non-resistance, pacifism. So we don't take up arms when it's in times of war. That would be a uniqueness to the Mennonite Brethren that other denominations don't have. But the rest of our 17 statements, you could take them and say, as Anglicans, you know what? We agree with all of those things. That pacifism thing, not so sure about that, but everything else is great. So what we've said to guys is, you know, you can argue if you want about church polity, you can argue about multi-baptism, you can argue about Israel and future events, you can argue about church and state relationships. I mean, if you want to spend all your time arguing about those things, you will find somebody in the room who disagrees with you. You can have a wonderful time. But if instead you would focus on the 95 or plus percent that we agree upon, put Jesus in the middle of the room and the gospel in the middle of the room and say, that's what we're on about. So that's where our focus and working together is going to be. So gospel-centered, the proclamation of the Word of God. Secondly is a Spirit-led movement. And again, we heard that this morning, I think going into our prayer time at the close, that, I mean, Jesus said it so clearly, no one comes to me unless the Father draws him. Not by might, not by power, but by my Spirit. Unless the Lord builds a house, you labor in vain. I mean, just start quoting them off, and you got dozens of scriptures. Bind the branches, apart from me, you can do nothing. So the whole Spirit-led focus is a prayer focus that says, oh God, how desperately our nation needs renewal and revival. And as Alistair just said, yes, we have a part to play. We're the hands and the feet and the voice of Jesus to our generation, but we can preach till the cows come home, and unless the Spirit of God shows up and ignites the heart, So we've got to be crying out. And the workshop I'm looking for this afternoon is that question in the sanctuary, awakening. What would it take to see an awakening again? And Canada has really never known an awakening, like some of the historical movements. And what would that be like if 36 million from coast to coast, if we could see a spiritual wave sweep across the country? I mean, wouldn't that be, you know, could the God visit us in that way? So gospel-centered, spirit-led, and then the third value that unites all these denoms is the mission focus. And by that we mean simply that whole issue of lostness, that the reason you plant a church is not because you don't like your senior pastor, not because you're going to do it better, not because a different style of worship is, you know, better than this. And so case in point, I was interviewing a guy on the prairies a couple weeks ago. First interview, want to plant a church, why do you want to plant a church? And these were literally his words. There's not a single church in this town that my wife and I want to attend, so we want to plant a church that we would like to attend. And we think there's lots of other people like us. So he started telling us about all these D-church people. And that's true. There are a ton of D-church people that we should try to win back to the church. I'm all for that. But as he talked more and more, I finally said, you know, cool, some of the stuff you're saying. I've not heard you talk about evangelism yet. Yeah, I can just tell you evangelism is not my thing. I'm not an evangelist, not really into that. What I want to do is I want to gather people like us. And in the back of my head, I'm like, yeah, we're not working with this guy. Because the mission is all wrong. It's about him and his desires, and he's going to apparently plant the perfect church that he wants to attend, like yours. So how do 16 denoms work together? We just keep bringing it back. Those three things: gospel centrality, spirit-led movement, and mission focus. And if we can stay on those and then leave the arguments on the secondary issues. So that's how we're trying to work together. It's not always easy, but it's fun. Yeah. It's very exciting.
And sometimes, I know the skepticism of, like, you hear of an interdenominational effort and it sounds just kind of utopian. And I had the same skepticism because when I initially agreed to plant with CDC, I had decided where I was going to affiliate denominationally, and was thinking Anglican, and I was, you know, at the time CDC was mostly based in BC, and I had to sit down in front, you know, 15 people on the board at the time, and I got grilled about infant baptism, and I started thinking, like, man, I thought this wasn't going to be like this, gave my answers, and then at the end of it, they're like, all right, cool, we'll plant with you, you know, I was like, and I've seen, like, I have not been treated like the redheaded stepchild of the network as, like, the only Anglican plant at the moment. But they actually really do honor our distinctives. And with other planters, we get into arguments sometimes just for fun, you know. It's got nothing better to do, apparently. But I do want to emphasize that my experience has been that CDC honors the centrality of, you know, a gospel-centered approach, spirit-led, mission-focused. And when you listen to Charlie talk about the five priorities, you can see great overlap. And I think that's why it was such an easy decision to partner, is the synergy between the values. Now, we can go through the 10 best practices. You're saying you're going to touch on them.
We won't. I mean, tomorrow. So flip to page 31, 32, and I mean, we can do these questions, but when you're asking how you do this, so the what and the why is fair. These.
Do you have extra books?
Yeah.
Does anyone not have a book?
You don't have
You got one.
You got two.
I got two now.
There you go. So page 32. No,
like fish and bread.
There may be, one day there may be more, there may be less than 10, but these came out of, in the simplest way, seeing so much church failure, church planting failure. Say, how do we stem the tide? And some stats would say 80% of churches failed in the first 5 years, was kind of in historical, in North America. We use an illustration, like the funnel illustration. It used to be that if church funding was this giant funnel, anybody and everybody can jump in the top of the funnel, and out the bottom drips 20% success rate, and then somehow we were okay with that. And our national director said, you know, what if we take that funnel and turn it on its end and make the narrow end the entry point and make it very difficult for people to get in? So have very thorough assessment process, very thorough training, very thorough coaching, and all of those things. Once they make it through that process, then the funnel opens up and then resource them with every possible resource that you can give them, from ongoing training to coaching and financial systems and administration and government details, all those things that have to take place. But let's make it harder to get in, and once they're in, then resource them and hopefully turn that on its tide. Now, we're one small network in North America. We work with about 100 couples right now. So comparison to some networks in the States who are much larger, it's a small movement. But in those 100 couples, I would say our success rate so far, and we're very young, is at the 90-95% rate. We have shut down 2 or 3 plants in the last 9 years. That's true. But when we shut down, we would say it's better to shut it down before they get out of the gate than to let them get out of the gate and then 5 years later have to shut them down. So that's where these best practices come from. So we put these all in place to try to make the success rate greater. That's a bit on the how.
So I think as we work through some of your questions now, we're going to reference these best practices along the way. And so keep that page open. Obviously, you might have some more questions arising, so keep those on your mind too. While Mark was talking, I tried to organize your questions thematically. I actually want to start with, and you touched on this a bit, but the question of competition came out of Halifax. I can't remember who asked it. And then another question was, how do we partner with existing denominations? And I think what Mark was saying about, in Canada, we don't have the option of being in our own silos anymore. It's very crucial. The only way that I've found to kill the competitive spirit is to have a kingdom focus of the church. It happen out of one denomination. It's going to happen by Christians reclaiming the authority of the Word of God, filled with the Spirit, and God working by Word and Spirit, and you could add as Anglican sacrament if you desire, which is fine. But this has to come together. And so the first thing, I think, is developing a robust vision of the kingdom. That, hopefully all of your churches say one of the creeds every Sunday. One holy Catholic and apostolic church. Like, you have to take Catholicity very seriously. And I think ANIC does, especially when it comes to terms like ACNA as large, trying to work with Orthodox groups and trying to take seriously this call to Catholicity, but I think we also have to be willing to look to other Protestant brothers and sisters and say, like Mark is saying, where is our source of agreement? And so St. Peter's, frankly, like my own experience, we've partnered with other denominations more than we've partnered with other ANIC parishes. And that's not by choice. It's just we're geographically focused downtown. We're the only ANIC parish downtown. And so we've partnered with almost every Orthodox church downtown in some capacity. We've done joint services with Artisan for Christmas 2 years in a row now. Coastal Church downtown, on our first Sunday launch, we found a very large check from them specifically in our offering. We've worked with First Baptist and Westside. Yeah, there's varying capacities, but we're finding even just downtown that this collaborative spirit already exists. And if there's church plants down the street from you, you should just meet and talk and be asking, how can we partner? And it might be big ways, it might be small ways, but those partnerships are going to be key for revival in Canada. If we don't learn how to work together as brothers and sisters, united in the gospel, I don't think we're going to see revival. We're just going to see a bunch of scattered efforts. So the how do we partner with other denominations, I actually think takes a willingness to dialogue and be creative. I don't want to say, like, this is how you do it specifically. I think the first thing starts with calling or emailing someone and asking them to grab lunch because you live in the same neighborhood and you pastor similar churches and you have shared values and you want to see if there's anything you can do together. Personally, I found Alpha a great way. So there's church planters who haven't yet launched on Sundays, and so I've invited them to participate when we run Alpha, and they can host a table. And I, at first, let me tell this story really quick. I won't go over too much time. First time we ran Alpha at St. Peter's, it was amazing. We had 65 guests come out, which was blew our minds. By the end of it, we had 15 remain. It's a big commitment, and only one person came to faith, and it was great, and she decided to get baptized at another church and then moved back to China. Now, the church planner in me bemoaned, like, I wanted to grow by one. And then the Spirit convinced me, like, first off, there's only one sacrament of baptism, right? So it doesn't matter which church she was baptized in. Second off, if I have a view of the kingdom, like, she's heading back to a great mission field. So we needed to make sure, how are we making sure that she's going to get discipled over there? And so we started inviting other planters to our alpha, and they can have a table, and we don't hoard, like, well, we invited these people, so they're going to be at these tables, and you invited those people, so they'll be at your table. I said, no, like, just care for people, and whatever church they land at the end of the day doesn't matter as much as them hearing the gospel and getting plugged into a truly orthodox and theologically grounded community. So that's just one example. We were asked to name some models. You listed two. The missionary model, which is very Pauline, is you just kind of parachute into a new area. You might have a spouse. You might have one or two people with you, but you're starting from scratch, and you're figuring out how to network and how to cultivate a team. There's the mother-daughter approach, where a resourced church or a somewhat resourced church is willing to commission you and send people with you and resource you for a period of time. There's the restart approach, where the church is on its way out, and there's maybe 20 people left, 30 people left, and you decide to close that church, but all of the members of that church agree or decide to come or go, I guess, and to relaunch in the same location. It's becoming more and more frequent. Multi-site, yeah, where you a church plants another campus. You know, again, in our ecclesiology, that gets a little more complicated, but that's what the table's doing. Essentially, they've become a multi-site church. They don't use video venue, but they have multiple locations, and they share a common DNA, they share resourcing. It's a very creative solution, especially when it comes to some of the financial questions, but I know you guys have specific questions there.
Probably other very common is church within a church, where an ethnic group or a demographic group different from the main congregation will meet in the same facility, maybe share a lot of resources, children's and youth ministries, obviously administrative systems, all the central services, but have two distinct congregations sharing a facility.
So there's no right model. I think that needs to be very clear. I had the privilege of getting to speak at one of the AMIC conferences, and it was a very big eye-opener for me, because I didn't go in thinking there was one model, but I talked a lot about what I had done. And I realized that I had discouraged a few people, because what they were doing was very different, and they started thinking, well, should I close shop because I didn't do it a certain way? And I was, no. There's lots of ways to do this. What we want to figure out is, where's the Spirit at work there? Now, and we'll get on the financial piece in a bit, but I do think part of ANIC, for us to be able to plant successfully in the long term, we do need to plant in urban centers, and we do need to see resources invested into those plants so that they can become resource centers for church planting. So we need more St. John's Vancouver's, right? St. John's can't keep floating our entire denomination for church planting. You know, we need to see God work in that area. But that can't be our only effort either, because rural areas matter, and they might take a slightly different approach, though, right? You might not have a church, so you might have to go the more missionary approach. So as we talk about different approaches throughout the day, don't take what's helpful, but don't think, well, since I don't have the mother-daughter option, I shouldn't do this. There are other ways. I think there is an advantage to a mother-daughter plant. I actually think there's principles of churches planting churches that can be very helpful, but that can take a lot of different expressions, like a church adopting a church plant across Canada and saying, we're going to fund you as much as we're able, we're going to pray for you as much as possible, and we're going to encourage you. So there's lots of creative solutions there.
Well, a question I have for you is, Andre, in relationship to liturgical, most of us being Anglicans have the perspective that the person in front of the congregation has a collar on and a robes. I'm wondering now if that's really got to be passé. Is there any example that is less effective with the people who do not identify with that collar or with the robed person? If you're bringing new people to Christ, you know, what's the success of that?
Sure. And I think that jumps onto the question of younger people moving back towards liturgy, which, sorry, I can't remember your name.
Michael.
So maybe I can touch on that briefly if everyone's okay with that. I'm obviously not wearing a collar, so you know where I stand. No, I do wear a collar. I have no problem. Like, I think, again, the question shouldn't be framed, but maybe shouldn't, is there? Let's consider different ways we could frame the question. I think we get caught up a lot in expression in church, right? And I think it's a mistake. Not because expression doesn't matter, but it's what's driving that expression that matters, right? And so I was a pastor at a megachurch in the States for a season. I wasn't the lead pastor, I was just one of many, and 5,500 people, you know, on the day of Sunday. And very low-key, I probably dressed more informally than this because it was Florida and it was hot. And, you know, we had our liturgy. 3 songs, announcements, song for an offering, sermon, 3 songs. That was it. No speaking in unison, nothing. But it was a liturgy, right? Now, I drank an Anglican Kool-Aid while I was in seminary, and so I started to like liturgy and wondered why were certain elements missing. And what I realized is the success of the contemporary movement isn't so much that they took the most accessible parts of the service. I actually argue that they took the most inaccessible parts. Because to me, when I first became a Christian, there's nothing more awkward than singing songs with a bunch of people about Jesus. And there's nothing more awkward than listening to someone talk for 45 minutes about Jesus, or 30 or 15, whatever. You know, but to me, those are actually the 2 most awkward elements. And yet, people are coming. What is it? And I realized it's not so much what you do, but how you do it. Right? And so we can go back to Cranmer, and the goal was common prayer. Right? So Cranmer really cared about language being recontextualized for the common person. He really cared about it when you read his journals and other writings about the meaningful participation, that people could actually understand what's happening. So, yeah, you could wear robes in your plans, but you got to help people understand why. And so St. Peter's, I mean, we're a low church by many standards. We don't have robes. We occasionally wear collars. You mean in a basement, you know, and we keep the church calendar, we keep other Anglican distinctives. We have a very robust liturgy. And the liturgy draws people, not so much, I think, the liturgy in of itself. I do think there is a generation of people turning to liturgy, but there's also 3 major churches surrounding us that are contemporary and reaching far more people than we are, right? So there's a movement, but I don't want to say it's a definitive movement of liturgy. It's definitely something that I think speaks powerfully in our current cultural time where people have been devoid of history.
And I think, to that issue, I think that the issue is addressing those with a church background or at least a memory of church. Mm-hmm. So like many of our neighbors, we're in a condo a few blocks from here, 36 units. As far as we know, we're the only church attenders in the building. But there are people in the building with Catholic background, with Anglican background, so their memories would take them maybe to a liturgical service. But for the new person walking in the door, which most millennial in Canada have never been inside the doors of any church, they don't have a clue what goes on. So they're freaked out by a contemporary church just as much as a liturgical church. So I think it's more than what liturgy are you using, whether it's contemporary or traditional. It's the spirit of the people. It's are you welcoming to the newcomer? Does the newcomer come on the arm of the friend, which is we know the majority do. So if I'm attending St. Peter's, which you know we've been there a few times and love it, my wife, if she had her choice, would attend there, and I told her you can't. So, but frankly, we have said, given the neighborhood we live in, I think our neighbors would more likely go to St. Peter's than they would to the church we attend. That's very, very contemporary. Because their memories are more like what you guys are doing here.
Yeah, and so it's the how, yeah. I think. And Cranmer was passionate about the how behind the why. You know? And we, real simple example is like there's aspects that we recognize are weirder on Sunday than not. But when I start just doing my cultural research, talking to people in the city, I experiment. I would just walk up to people and say, hey, I'm starting a new church. If you went to church, what would you expect? I'd expect you to probably read from the Bible. I'd expect you to pray. I'd expect you to talk about, you know, what you believe. No one said, like, I expect it to be accessible. I expect it to be something. Like, they actually, the things we tend to cut in the contemporary movement were the things that people, just if they're guessing, would probably be in the service. And so what we've done is say something like the creed. You got to figure out your rubrics. So we invite people to stand and we say, if you're a guest with us, we realize this might not be your word. These might not be your words. Feel under no obligation to say it. But as a community, we profess what it is we believe. And together with Christians throughout the ages and throughout the centuries, that's what we profess. That's 10 seconds. But all of a sudden, the person who's there for the first time, A, has permission not to say it, and B, understands why we're saying it. So in our service sheets, we explain everything. And that's important for the contextualizing.
You mentioned Ed Stetzer.
Yep.
If you've read any of his stuff, you know. And his first church plant failed.
Yep.
And his first church plant was in Buffalo. This addresses your issue. And the reason it failed is because, or the reason he would say that it failed, is because they didn't meet in a church building. It was very, very large Roman Catholic demographic. And you don't have a building. So how can you be a church? So, and I'm just throwing it in. There's no magic bullet.
No, there's not.
There ain't no magic bullet. What works in one place doesn't work in another place.
Well, let me pick up on that. I think I'm going to use the quote tomorrow, but one of my favorite one-liners out of Chronicles is Chronicles 12:32. David's mighty men are listed, and in the middle of it, men of Issachar who understood their times and knew what Israel should do. So we need to understand our times, and both culturally and theologically and all of that. So to that key issue, Montreal is seeing a resurgence of church planting and evangelism like crazy. Like never, this generation is saying we've never ever seen this happen. But what happened in the 60s with the Silent Revolution and the pushing away from the church, all the new church plants then did not meet in church buildings, cathedrals, because it's seen as being too Catholic. Now, 50 years later, 60 years later, all of our plants are going back in and taking over the cathedrals because of your reason. The generation is wanting sacred. So these millennials whose grandparents rejected Catholicism, walked away, whose parents raised them as pagans, are now going, well, there's an empty building right there. Why are we meeting in a school gym when we could have that cathedral with a gorgeous architecture? Let's get that building. So it's working in Montreal, but that might not work in whatever, Buffalo, or you pick it. So I think there isn't a magic bullet, to quote you.
Anna, you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm at the table, and I think the one thing we've learned in our team is you can never assume where people are at. You have to ask them. And so a year ago, we were teaching a lot about the sacraments because most of our folks have no idea what that is. And then when it came to trying to find a site for our North site this last year, we tried out a couple of locations, and it turned out that people really liked a church builder, and people really liked a more traditional space. And when we tried a more multi-purpose space, they weren't comfortable there. And that's just how the community had grown and progressed in the last year. So we just found it's, you just always have to be talking to people and figuring out where they're at and giving them a chance to give their feedback. And it's never necessarily what you expect, but you have to be able to respond to that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that just responsibly, you were saying earlier about Ed Stetzer and his first church plant being perceived as failure. I'm not sure what our idea of failure or success is, ultimately. If the Lord calls you to do something, you just go and do it.
Right.
Ultimately, you don't know for a season. You might not have church after, 5 years of planting. You may have impacted people's lives, and ultimately we're called to be God's water voice, bring water where he tells us to bring water. In the end, really. I mean, if our vision of a successful church plant is church planted, which is obviously what we'd like to see, sometimes that's not where the Lord is working and what the Lord is doing. He's asking us to be faithful in the steps of what he's asking us to do. It could be even more for us than it's for the people. but you don't know who and what you're impacting, what ground you're breaking by being faithful in those steps.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
You can't. I'm just going to give a quick caveat. It's great feedback. It's, again, that we're not so much trying to dialogue with one another in this time, because we have a whole bunch of priests who have a whole bunch of ideas. And I agree with that. Just so you know, I came to faith in a church plant in East Vancouver that was 5 years later, and I'm planting because of my experience in that. So how do you measure success? Again, the ideal way to plant in churches. Advice for planting from scratch. Someone asked that. What do you do in that scenario? And I think that is going to be quite frequent. I know a lot of the Advent churches start from scratch in Anik, right? And if you're in an area where you don't have a church yet in Anik, you're going to be starting from scratch. The first thing you need to be considering is timeline. Like, what are your expectations? You know, do you have a job? Can you do the kind of tent making approach if you don't have finances? You always have to get that figured out. And that's where C2C can come in and help and assess and all that. But what you need to, the work of church planting is the work of contextualization. You need to know your neighborhood. You need to know the people. You need to know not just demographics, but ethnographic research. What are their idols? What are their hopes? What are their fears? What are their general political affiliations? What are their concerns for the neighborhood? Like, these are the sort of things that you need to discover. And to do that, you need to go to a variety of areas. You know, I think when I was in New York at the training with Redeemer, they said to me, when you choose your neighborhood, you should be able to name everything on every street for like a 4-block radius. And I can do that now because it took a few years, but I took the time to visit places and get to know people and ask them questions. And in that process, I started to find a launch team. I started to find people who expressed interest in what I was doing. Again, after a year of work, I had 8 people. So it's not going to be quick work, but building a launch team is something that takes a lot of time and creativity. And one of the things we did was an event called Beer and Theology. We held it at a place called the Sin Bin, and we used a site called Meetup to promote it. And at its peak, we had 40 or 50 people who do not yet believe in Jesus coming up, mostly atheists or New Age. And no one joined our church in that effort. And we did it 12 or 14 times.
I would have.
I learned so much because people would just lay out everything they believe, and it made me a more effective communicator with the people who are expressing some interest. It helped me contextualize what our strategy would be as a church, and so creativity is going to be a huge piece. Unfortunately, the Spirit of God is one of the first places we see the Spirit of God acting is in Exodus, where he bestows creative powers upon people for the construction of tabernacles. So the Spirit of God will give you creativity for your unique skill set and your unique context. So just be okay. If you're starting from scratch, just realize building your launch team is going to take a lot longer than you'd like.
Let me add 2 things to that. And this is where I would say the partnership with network and assessment can help you. 2 things that would be absolutely critical in a scenario like that we would look at is, number one, the calling. And we listen. Calling is a language that, again, is one of those languages that the church in some circles are losing. It's more of I respond to a need, an opportunity. It's a job. It's a career. And you say, is the Spirit of Jesus really called you? You must do this. You cannot not do this. Because if you're going to go into a pioneering or a missionary model of planting, every kind of church plant is difficult. That's probably the most difficult. Parachute your family into a new community and sink or swim. God bless you. If you don't know crystal clear that God by His Spirit is calling you there, and we would say husband and wife both. So we have intentionally interviewed them as couples, and we have some scoring tools, church leader inventory, church leader spouses inventory they both take. Because if the spouse isn't supportive, in any environment it's difficult, but particularly in a pioneering environment. So has God called you would be first and foremost. And then secondly, has God gifted you? So that whole apostolic, entrepreneurial, whatever you want, word you want to use, gifting that we believe God has given to some people. And the pioneer planter in particular has to have an apostolic bent. So there's some tools, there's some inventories, there's some, you know, just a 360 evaluation of people looking at your life and going, yeah, you're the kind of person who's always started something new. Whether it was in business or in, you know, you're a kid and you have a lawn mowing business as a 12-year-old. Why? Because you're just bent that way. And then that apostolic calling. So, you know, the apostles, prophets, evangelists tended to be the ones to start the church, get it up and running, and then the pastor, teachers, and shepherds take it over and, you know, care for people. And typically, we've not had the fivefold ministry functioning well in any given church because the apes, if you will, the APEs, upset church people because they're always stirring the pot, right? But they're the kind of people that launch new works. So if somebody was saying to us, you know, like Alistair as an example, we're going to come to Vancouver, and the question back in assessment days, I mean, they were this mega church in Florida, Canadian by heritage, so coming home, but from Victoria, not from Vancouver, and saying, why Vancouver? Why that neighborhood? And you weren't crystal clear on a specific neighborhood yet. They ended up down on the peninsula, and we're like, why the peninsula of all places? But if they weren't crystal clear that God had called them there and drawn them there, we probably would have said, no, don't do that. And then looking at the giftings and going, okay, the guy's got an entrepreneurial gift, an entrepreneurial bent, cover that with scripture and say we call that an apostolic leaning. Yeah, this is the kind of couple that can make it happen. So those are a couple of additionals I would add to, you know, what you said.
We have a half hour, so I'm going to select a few questions that I think will broadly answer some of the other questions. Finances came up a few times. How do you grow the budget alongside the church? Which I said you don't, but I was being facetious. And then, yeah, how do we deal with finances as a small denomination that isn't terribly resourced in that capacity? The first is, I think, I've met too many planters and even just pastors who are just afraid to talk about money. And we've somehow disconnected tithing as not a part of the spiritual disciplines and not a part of an expression of maturity in Christ. And so you have to be willing to have those conversations with your people frequently and teaching on it. Like once a year at St. Peter's, we have a series on money, and we address various issues on money. We do it every year, and then we try to find one or two more times in the year to preach on money. We have financial updates every 6 weeks. We keep an offering within the service, and I know most of you probably do as a band within context, but a lot of church plants, they remove the offering because they think it'll be offensive. But all you have to say is, hey, nobody asked you here for your money. But if you're a member of the body of Christ, you know why we give. And then you get a short little window to remind people each one this that is expected of everyone who calls this church home. And not being afraid to make your need known. St. Peter's, we're, I don't know, $30,000 behind budget right now. We've made that need known, and I've said, this is what we need you to do. And we've seen it slowly come in. So I think there's a fear piece, and there's a faithfulness piece on our part. Are we actually giving people the opportunity to do this? Are we making our needs known to them? There is going to be that tension of our unique context. When I was in Florida, this is how the church did its budget. How many members do we have? What's their average income? What's 10% of that? And that's how they budgeted every year, and they never missed a budget. Yeah, but it's Florida. You know, you can do that there. You know, I mean, it still took a lot of teaching and a lot of faithfulness, and it was bold, but that was their context. Our context is, I can speak to St. Peter's, we have 35% students. And even if they're giving faithfully, it's not enough to pay our bills. I mean, you just have to be realistic about that. Their faithfulness matters, right? You don't want to undermine it, but it doesn't cover the rent. So what do? You have to be willing to, as Paul would say, pillage other churches for the sake of your work. And sometimes you might know your context better. I mean, Paul wouldn't ask for money in Corinth because he was worried about what that would say. So he robbed the churches in Macedonia for his work. We need to rob our American brothers and sisters. Now, some of us may not have that connection, and it's something, part of what I'm hoping to explore in the
next. I can hope you.
Yeah. Like St. Peter's, I would say 80% of our funding comes from the U.S. And at least our external fundraising. So right now, 50% of our budget is covered by our own giving, and 50% is raised, and most of that money that's raised comes from the States. Now, I'm fortunate to have come out of a context where I have lots of connections. You might be wondering, well, I don't have those connections, what do I do? What we're hoping to do, so the first year of me chairing this board was to establish this connection with C2C, get some good practices in. I'm hoping in the next year to start looking at possible financial sources for church planting efforts. And C2C also has, maybe you can talk a little bit about how
I agree with everything Alistair has said. Once the church is up and running, and we see this so many times where a leader in the church is afraid to talk about money. And we're just, you gotta talk about money. It's in the scriptures, you're teaching through the scriptures, you're gonna come to money, you've gotta teach your people about all the issues of life. So, I mean, guys are more upfront these days talking about every sexual issue in the world than they are talking about money. You're like, what is so scary about money? But many have talked about, so you've gotta teach on that. At the get-go, getting out of the gate, there are a number of organizations that will provide funding. Last week we were down at a church in Florida again, Spanish River Church, that has, for 40 years, their entire global mission thing is we support church planting. Started in the U.S., now they support around the world. This year, they will support 80 church planters in various locations around the world. So they partner with us as a network. So currently, it's just a handful, three or four of our planters in Canada have partnered with them. It's not a huge amount of money, but it's, you know, maybe 20,000, 30,000, that's a good start. Our network raises money, so we will come alongside denominations, and if you want to give us money, I'd gladly take your checks, because we still need to raise some money. But we come alongside planters, and we'll, you know, show up when a denomination isn't able to give. There are foundations out there that give money. But when you start walking with a planter, and you say, you know, it's not rocket science. If you say 3, 4, 5 years, we want to believe that God will have the church up, self-sustaining from a financial point of view, which is not an unrealistic goal in most settings. Okay, how do we get through that first 5 years? It's amazing the number of partners that would say, we will support you for 3 years. They know there's an end date, so can you give us $50 a month for the next 3 years? And how many friends and family do we know? So you start going through your list and going, you know what? I think those people could afford $50 a month. And if they know at the end of 3 years, I'm not going to chase them anymore. So a guy that planted in Victoria, he looked for 50 friends to give him $50 a month for 50 months in his case. He went 4 years and a bit. And the guys had such financial strength in the early days, and now they're just, that is beginning to end. Chris Sinusol. So there's various methods, and we can help you with that as far as coaching. I mean, many others can help you with that. But what we have found is money generally is not the issue that stops the church from growing. Money comes where there's mission and vision happening. And so the more important issues are, you know, is the gospel being preached, or people coming to faith in Jesus, and it's amazing how those kind of issues, donors will come alongside. So, and it's not that it's not important, it's critically important, but we wouldn't put that at the top tier issue to deal with. Okay, how are you going to pay for it first? That'd be like number 7 or 8 on the list.
Can I say, I think that the ask often is more effective if it comes from somebody else. So, I've raised money for pastor residence programs for 1 year for priests who's burned out to be supported for a year. And I write a letter to those 50 friends and family and say, look, these are the goals this person has. Would you be willing to support them? And I think writing on behalf of someone
can generate some slides. So some of you who worried about writing the letter, if you provide me with the goals, I'll write the letter for you.
I'll be sending you an email today.
Yeah. I mean, like, case in point, so are you with Jonathan at the table? Okay, so you say, and I have no clue how you guys do this as a network, but if all of your churches would just say, we'll give 1% of our income towards new churches, that is a huge amount of money across the board. Yeah. Like, it sounds like next to nothing, but if every congregation or parish gave just 1%, put it into a central pool. So even if you in this room said, we would go back to our parishes and said, hey, could we give, there's a new church going to start in Victoria. By God's grace, there's going to be this emerging community called The Table. They need financial resources in these early days. Could we give 1% of our budget for the next 2 or 3 years? Channel it through these guys, channel it through us, channel it wherever you want to channel it, I don't care, and get it to them. You're like, what a strength that is. And the other thing that comes with money is then you get prayer and partnership. Because anytime a church is sending money to an organization or to a church, then suddenly they're interested. And they're praying and they're reading the newsletters and they're visiting you when they come to Victoria, and it's like, yeah, it's very cool.
I'd just like to offer a, like, from a Canadian perspective, for the last 5 years we've been planting, and 100% of the income is coming from Canada. You know, so you don't have to have a relationship with the States, so you don't feel overwhelmed. 100% is coming from Canada. It's been awesome to see the Lord provide, you know, and it's great to, it, and it's not, but it's multi-denominational, it's not just Anakin.
Yeah.
Cool.
Question?
Yes, Mark and Alistair, C2C network, if I'm hearing, if I check the website, there will be a church planters 16 module. You have to go through this 2 years thing before you start? Or is it on OJT, on job training,
yes,
double track, and being followed by you as your mentor, the church planter? The second question is that when I talk about the financial template, you know, 10 practices, again, is it included in the church planters module, or is it not concurrent? Because as you are on OJT, on job training, you need to have some of this financial base. The third question is, like Alistair, when you talk about 1500 from an American kind of experience, and now you join Link in partnership with C2C Network. Now, if I hear, am I correct? Correct me if I'm wrong. You have to give a 1% to the C2C network so that they can mushroom to help other church planting endeavors. Apart from you being an Anglican, you've got to commit to a certain quota. So these are the three questions. Thank you.
Okay. So no, C2C doesn't ask. He doesn't give anything to C2C, or isn't asked to or required to. We invite him to, sure. And most of our church plants actually do give back either to the network or to another church plant. We encourage them, take some of your, every church gives outside ministries, missions, etc. Make sure some of that's going to church planting. So, but there's not a required amount. The other question?
On the job training.
So incubator is one of the training modules you use. Redeemer, Tim Keller's material, they took it and codified it down to 16 principle-based training for church plants. And actually, Alistair went through the, they offer it in a couple forums, an intensive. You can go to New York City for 5 weeks, and it's like a fire hydrant, just get it all. Or you can spread it over a two-year period. And so we meet in cohorts, and we currently have 9 of these in Canada. We've got one here in Vancouver, and Alistair is actually one of our facilitators. So there's 3 church planters who facilitate these discussions. So 10 guys are in the program. There's like a couple hundred pages worth of reading. They do in advance. They come to an all-day meeting. They dig into the reading, and it really is on-the-job training. In an ideal setting of the 16 modules, you would complete modules 1 to 8 in pre-launch phase, and modules 9 to 16 in the first year of your launch, but it never works out perfectly. So we're like, take it whenever you can take it, and if it happens to be perfect timing, great. So you got guys, well, you have a couple guys in yours who are actually already out of being launched.
Yeah.
Some who are in apprenticeship and some in pre-launch, so they're all over the map.
The apprenticeship will be probably more creative for us because what C2C does is they pay for someone to apprentice within a church plant to learn church planting. Now, for some of the Anik plants, like say, I've talked to the national director of C2C about this. He said, if I had a Presbyterian guy, he's going to plant a Presbyterian church, but he needs a church context I can give him like to you for 2 years paid, and he'll serve you. Would you be willing to have that person come, even if it doesn't mean you're going to plant a name in the church? Now, obviously, you'd have to talk to your bishop, and obviously, you would need to consider your context if that would actually be helpful. But that's another, how far are we willing to go to support denominational work? Because we've only got 15 minutes, I want to address a bigger question that will probably cover the last few questions, and that was, how do you do the culture shift stuff? Either shutting down a church and relaunching it, or you're a transplant church and you're trying not to fall into old patterns, and how do you take an old DNA that doesn't have any missional identity, how do you create a new DNA, and another question is, what skill set do you look for in the launch team? And I think those are actually all issues. Questions of culture. And this is probably, there's no, again, no formula to this, because you're going to hear me emphasize this every time. Like, there's always a context, there's always a people, there's always a place, and you have to be evaluating these things. One of the basic things that I think is important is, it's called the triangle. It's a very simple shape. We're all taught it, right? But at the top, and for developing your philosophy of ministry, you have your theological vision. These are your non-negotiables. And then on another point, you have the context of your place. So I'm downtown Vancouver. I could tell you everything and anything about downtown Vancouver. The third point, though, is actually the uniqueness of the church planter. What is his or her skill set? And what is that? What are their preferences? What are their dreams? What are their hopes? What are their aspirations? What are their talents? What are their shortcomings? All of these three things come together to develop your philosophy of ministry. And what I've found, and Mark might find this more, but usually people are going to be strong in two of those areas and negligent in one. C2C is not going to work with anyone who doesn't have their theological vision down. Right? So that's usually strong. But I mean, I could tell you all about Vancouver. I would have a difficult time telling you about myself, initially. Where you can give me other people who they can tell you everything and anything about themselves, can't tell you much about the place. And so I think part of the culture shift is very important as the planter or the leader to know yourself very well. What are your shortcomings? What are these bad habits you don't want to fall back into? What are their roots, though? Are they just symptoms? Is there a root problem that needs to be addressed? The other is, in developing culture, the only way to really build culture is values within a team. Is do you understand the values that are being communicated? Because most people, we've abandoned speaking of values. We want more authentic things. We don't want to cast what our values should be. But everyone has values. It's how we mediate our inner and outer realities. And do you see what values your team is operating by? Are you casting a picture for what those values could be? Basic communication theory is going to be helpful. Person A, person B. Right? We look at Mark and I, we know each other for 4 years, we've worked together. You'd say we have a relationship. But there's actually two relationships. There's person A's experience of person B and all of his background and how he interprets what I say, and there's person B's experience of person A. And if you don't work from that awareness with people, it's called an undifferentiated relationship. You're assuming everyone has the same information, and you're going to fall into all these cultural issues then, because someone might be driving you nuts, like on your launch team. Why are they doing this? And because they're hearing you, but they're interpreting differently. And so what you want to work from is a differentiated mindset, whereas there's always more going on. In this, there's two relationships. In your church plant core team, there's 90, and there's only 20 people for president, right? And so you have to learn then, what are the values that need to be instilled within myself to mediate my inner reality, my calling, my vision, my hope for this, with the outer reality, the team. But also, what are the values that they're bringing? And do some of your values need to change? And this has to happen in conversation in our cultural context. In the States, let me clarify really quickly. I think it has to happen in urban predominantly white culture is becoming increasingly suspicious of authority, and so collaboration and conversation is very important. I would say second generation Chinese are also starting to have this suspicion of authority, so collaboration is important, but certain ethnic groups might actually have more comfort with top-down leadership. So I don't want to make a blanket statement, but this top-down vision casting of this is my vision, these are the values, that's where you're going to probably start actually running into some culture issues, just in the Canadian context. You might know where you want to get people, but you have to help them get there. Mm-hmm. And that has to happen in intentional conversation. And you've got to have that frequently and regularly, and you have to be willing to have uncomfortable conversations. And if you don't, that's when you're going to find you're going to slip into old habits, or you're going to be constantly running into conflict. And so the culture that you're attempting to create is always an issue of contextualization. It's always an issue of communication, and it's always an issue of presence. And if you remove any of those things, you're going to run into culture problems. To instill a missional vision, and then I think this is important, because this is a big piece of church planting culture. I've read enough books on it now where people say, you just need to talk about mission all the time. Make sure people know what your mission is. And this is important. People should have a sense that the church never exists only for itself, that Christ gave birth to the church for the sake of the nations and the world to be reconciled to the Father, that mission is at the heart of God because he made creation to realize the church. He sent his son to redeem his people. Like, the heartbeat of God is mission. What I've found, at least from my own experience, is the more I beat the myth of the drum, the more I just create people who can say the right things but don't necessarily do mission. The more I preach the gospel and show how Christ is beautiful and worthy of being glorified and worthy of all our affections, our emotions, our desires, mission flows naturally. And so if you want to cultivate mission, it actually comes down to a robust preaching of the gospel. And when I say preaching the gospel, I don't even just mean the pulpit. I mean, if you have a team of four, what I did with my initial launch team, 8 people, we studied the gospel for 16 weeks, and we assigned passages, and people would have to teach one another the gospel, and then articulate it in their own words. And what we found is the more that people understood the gospel, evangelism just starts happening. It's not that we never talked about evangelism, but their hearts were beating for Jesus again. And so when you preach the gospel in any and every context, you can speak to believers and encourage them. You can speak to the unbeliever, the lost, and save them. You can sleep to the sleepy nominal Christian and wake them back up. But the gospel is the only way to speak to all those groups at once. And so if you want to really cultivate mission, it has to be through the proclamation of the gospel, because at the heart, the gospel is missional.
Jump in a couple more. Switching of the DNA, they say, who are they? But after 5, 6, 7 years, the culture of the church or your parish begins to reflect your leaders. So give yourself patience and time. And if you've been there 6, 7 years and you're not content with the culture, maybe you need to look in the mirror and say, they're following me. And if this is what the result is, maybe there's some issues. So you need to ask yourself, am I a person who's living on mission? And I think we can give our people some very simple tools or, handles to hang things off of. But some of the simple ones are just ask them, show me your prayer list. Like, literally show me your prayer list. Do you have a list of names of non-believing people that you are faithfully praying for? It might be 3 people, it might be 10 people, it might be 100 people, I don't know, but who are you praying for that's lost? When's the last time you had dinner with your non-believing neighbor? How many times a month do you have coffee or a meal with somebody who doesn't yet know Jesus? That's a very easy, tangible thing to say, well, it was last Friday, we had the neighbors over and we watched the game and then we visited, whatever, something along those lines. There's some great tools out there. A little book called The Art of Neighboring is a great book. Pastors in Denver met with the mayor and talked about the problems in Denver, and then the mayor made this statement to 50 pastors. Non-believing mayor says, you know what, I think 70% of Denver's problems could be solved if our people would just learn to be good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so these pastors are like, here, the mayor is teaching us. So they came up with just some simple handles. One of them is to take a grid, drive cut it in three, you got nine squares, put you in the middle. Now there's eight people around you, and wherever you live, who are the eight people closest to you? If you're in a typical block area, you can name them. If you're in a condo, whatever. How much do you know about those eight people? Can you name the first name of all eight people? Can you name the first and second name and maybe the family names of those eight people? Do you know anything about them, what they do for a living? And then the third question would be, do you know anything about their spiritual belief? So they took a survey, and it was shocking. It was like 20% could actually even name the first names of all eight people. Like 10% or less could name the first and last names. And it was something like 1% that could name something spiritual about all eight. And you're going, that's just those eight. That's really close to me. So for me, this is a challenge. Having done 23 years in pastoral ministry and now working in this network where you're disengaged from the local church on an ongoing basis, the question for us is, are we living on mission? Because I don't want to be telling stories from 5 years ago in our church this took place. I want to tell the stories now in our condo, our Latvian neighbors who just got home from their, you know, time in Latvia are telling us their story, and they're far from Jesus, but they came up and they brought a bottle of some funny liquor that they drink in Latvia. So those are the stories that we need to be engaged in, and if we can share that with our people, then they're like, oh, okay, Alistair and Julie, you guys are living on mission. Like, you're having unbelieving people in your life. You're meeting them, and whether it's in the condo or on the street or in the coffee shop, so that they can look to you and go, okay, you can do it, and you're not that smart. I can do it.
We are running out of time. So what I want to ask is, are there any lingering questions? Because I'll take them down. Because these questions are great, and some of them warrant more consideration. But again, I want to create helpful resources for us on the ANIC website. So if there's any more questions, please just throw them over.
So one thing that came to mind to me, I don't know, like, does CTC have the capacity to support anyone that wants to plant something within ANIC, or will there be multiple models that we need to follow?
Can you flesh that a little more, Lee?
So you have the different bits and pieces, like you guys go through to see how you know, is this fit for you and how's that good. But there's still going to be other people that may not fit your model,
sure, yeah,
that wants to do this,
yeah,
right? For whatever reason. And how do we help them to give it a go as well? Or do we discourage them, right? I mean, like, how do we encourage as many as possible without necessarily getting resources through C2C?
Sure.
It's sort of part of that on-the-job training, because we are in Halifax and we are the ANIC church in Nova Scotia. And, so we're planting, but we're without, not without resources. We know God is for resources, you know, but we have felt this need. And I'm looking at your, we have to go to this industry, and I'm like, ah.
We have a couple living in Halifax.
Pardon?
We have a CTC couple living in Halifax. We'd love to connect.
Yeah.
Let's talk afterwards.
So, I guess the question is, how do we create connection without creating burden?
Exactly.
You point us to page 32, which is the 10 best practices for C2C, but not actually the 10 best practices for a church that's 2 or 3 or 4 years into what they're doing.
Yeah.
So that was the piece that I was looking for.
2 to 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't get to that, you're right. That goes on the second half of your guys' vision, planting and growing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The growing half, which I think you're pressing into more in the next
week. Let's connect after the session with each other a little bit.
Okay. Alistair, our church, and I know several our churches that have come out from the Amy Church of Canada, been through trauma with that, we're aging as congregations. We need to get going again, and one of the models that you talked about was shutting down and then starting again, but not sure our folks would be too excited about that. So ideas around that about how to reboot.
I believe that in C2C network, apart from the question asked, like in the sense of an existing church that needs a rekindling or rebooting, then CDC can just come in and help. Now, can I ask another question concerning C2C network? This whole kind of a concept of strategic profiling, which is not mentioned about profiling, but I think what Alistair has been doing in the downtown area when you survey, I think this is where it's very urban. Am I right? A very primary urban kind of a thrust. Is it true?
With C to C.
C2C.
Yeah, I would say we began with a very urban focus, largely because we what the Canada Census calls urban. Now that's 10,000 pops, so it's a huge number. But 20% live in rural Canada, so rural Canada is a huge need, especially in this vast real estate that we have called Canada. But the truth is that our four major cities, which is like 45-50% of our population.
You all screwed up.
Are you lost?
I mean, I think the simple answer why we focus on cities so much, the influence of culture being shaped in the cities, but the reality is evangelicals have typically not done well in urban centers. We've fled to the suburbs, so it's why our downtown core is filled with old buildings that are empty in most cities, and then there's churches out in the surrounding areas. I don't know how many of you picked up an article in the 2010 Olympics. There was a guy from Pennsylvania, I've got the file somewhere, but he wrote an article on his reflections of having been to Vancouver in this gorgeous city and all this kind of stuff, the Olympics, blah, blah, blah. But he goes, but a very unique feature of this city, there were no steeples. So then he started to dig into this, that from an American perspective where he came from, the downtown core, he just said there were just next to zero churches. And it's true, there's almost 100,000 people live on the peninsula. 150, is that what it is? 15. 150, okay. There's a Southern Baptist guy doing the research, blah, blah, blah. 1892, there were seven evangelical churches on the peninsula. 1992, there were seven evangelical churches on the peninsula. There were 21 churches total. Now, in the last 10 years, a number of new churches have been planted. St. Peter's Parish, along with others. But still, for that population base, it's not more than 30 congregations of all stripes and breeds on the peninsula. So you go, based on population, is there a need in our cities? Absolute need. Our neighborhood doesn't have one solid evangelical witness where we are. There's seven congregations of various stripes and breeds, one that would have what we would say a gospel centrality in their ministry. The rest, nothing.
Any more lingering questions?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So please, if you feel like your question wasn't answered, I'll stick around and we can chat. Please know that on the board or the committee side of things, the hope is to further develop the church planting plan in the next year, but also now start working on some of the church growth resources. So that's phase two for us. So please know that that's not being put on the back burner. It's just, I only have so much time to do this process. I've been asked to say grace for our meal. Is it the meal that I'm saying grace for?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
By faith?
By faith, there will be food out there. So let's pray. Father, we love you. We're grateful that you're a God who dines with us. We're grateful that a meal is a picture of what life in your kingdom is like. So thank you for this food and this great community of fellowship. We ask that you grant us an awareness of your presence with us as we eat and enjoy one another. You bless our time of fellowship in Christ's powerful name. Amen. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.